You're listening to the Virginia Voice. We're currently halfway through our reading of today's Richmond Times-Dispatch. And before we return to that reading, we do have some birthdays to announce. For September 5th, that's a happy birthday to Jennifer Haynes and Melinda White. Once again, for September 5th, happy birthday to Jennifer Haynes and Melinda White. And we are back to the reading of the Richmond Times-Dispatch for Thursday, September 5th. For the Virginia Voice, your readers are Tim Vogel and Steve Hovjacki.
Our first opinion piece of today is by Jeff E. Shapiro. He writes, Sabato marks half-century at UVA. The Oracle of Charlottesville sees him and calls him. It was August 1960. Larry Sabato, then a schoolboy in the gritty Navy town of Norfolk, had just turned 8, and that's when the bug hit. John F. Kennedy had won the Democratic nomination for president. His chiseled mien and crisp forward-thinking rhetoric were propelling the new TV era of American politics. That Kennedy was of Irish descent and Catholic fed Sabato's curiosity about the 43-year-old Massachusetts senator. A fellow Catholic of Italian ancestry, Sabato reflected 64 years later on Kennedy's ascent. He said, "This was an opportunity for us as ethnics to become more mainstream." The only child of federal workers, Sabato, who had watched the broadcast of the Democratic Convention from Los Angeles, later went to the city Democratic headquarters with his father, collecting Kennedy for President palm cards, which he would distribute while going door to door. At one house, Sabato said he was greeted sternly by a woman. She said, "We don't support papists in this household," and then she slammed the door. I did not know what a papist was, but I learned that politics are big stakes. Politics isn't just a profession for Sabato, now 72. It's personal. Nothing speaks as convincingly of that as the platform from which, for a half century, he has lived and breathed politics, the University of Virginia. For 4 years as an undergrad and 46 years as a professor, Sabato has projected his signature brand of sprightly, pithy commentary, and by extension, the blue and orange profile of a university that's produced a bumper crop of politicians, but is synonymous with one, Thomas Jefferson, its founder, and a former governor and president. That Sabato is still at Virginia and has resisted overtures to forsake it for other universities, including Georgetown, Oxford, and Cambridge, speaks to his love of the school and the state of which is a powerful emblem, if not a somewhat embattled one, as a bustling arena where play out discomfiting struggles over race, gender, history, and the role of public higher education. This means that Sabato's portfolio as a tenured faculty member, assured lifetime job protection, and the freedom to speak his mind includes not just the latest twists and turns of political campaigns across Virginia and the country. Indeed, Sabato did not hesitate to decry the attempted overthrow in 2012 of UVA's first female president, Teresa Sullivan, warned 5 years later that protesting white nationalists could plunge Charlottesville into violence. Lament the perceived politicization of university governance by the left and right, and for nearly a decade regularly depict Donald Trump, as most Democrats and some Republicans view him, as a peril to the Republic. "You have an obligation to do it," he said. "The older and more senior you are, the greater the obligation to speak out." Sabato knows a thing or two about politics, having studied it for over a lifetime, but also having worked in it. From 1969 to 1977, he was a volunteer or on the paid staff of the three gubernatorial campaigns of Henry Howell, the peppery populist Democrat. harnessing an unlikely coalitions of big city black voters, rural whites, central left students, and suburbanites. Terrified but never toppled the conservative oligarchy that ruled Virginia since the late 1800s. In 1969, Sabato, intrigued by Howell's television commercials vowing a new day for the Old Dominion, showed up uninvited at the candidate's front door. Howell lived in Norfolk, in then a very Republican precinct in the leafy Larchmont section, across town from the Sabato's family house in a neighborhood near the Norfolk Naval Base. To Sabato's surprise, Howell joined him on the porch where they discussed campaigns and elections. Howell urged Sabato, a student at Norfolk Catholic High School, who would be considering the following year matriculating to Princeton University, but chose Virginia for such reasons as its affordability, to plunge into politics, and he did. He assisted Howell-aligned candidates for Congress when not working for Howell, even interrupting his graduate studies to head the Howell gubernatorial transition that wasn't in 1977, when Howell suffered his third and final defeat. Sabato was also drawn to Linwood Holton, elected in 1969 as Virginia's first Republican governor of the 20th century, urging progress on issues long neglected, the environment and racial reconciliation. "There, too, I got to know a bit," he said, who's conferred with every Virginia governor since Democrat Albertus Harrison in office from 1962 until 1966, except the office's current occupant, that Republican practitioner of performative politics, Glenn Youngkin. The state was changing very dramatically, but it was not clear in which direction. At UVA, Sabato would get a better sense of the state's path, studying under Weldon Cooper and Ralph Eisenberg, government scholars who kept a close eye on its often static politics for years, and were seeing signs of change that would fully flower by the late 1970s, when Sabato emerged as one of the few go-to analysts of contemporary Virginia politics. Sabato, he would take a graduate degree at Princeton and later was a Rhodes Scholar at Queen's College, Oxford University, landed at Charlottesville in the fall of 1970, as UVA was catching up with the 20th century. Admitting women, rather than risk being ordered to, it had gone to federal court and lost a bid to preserve its status as something of a men's finishing school. He would be elected president of the student government, defeating Wyatt Andrews, a future correspondent for CBS News, and later a UVA professor. Fast forward to 2024, though derided by critics as Dr. Dial-a-quote and Larry Sabotage, Sabato is a household name in political punditry. Students compete for seats in his classes. Sabato's brainchild, the Center for Politics, financed in part with the $2 million gift from Sabato, which recently began an expansion of its red brick quarters, is a hive for political leaders and scholars from around the country. Because Virginia's politics, not unlike its flagship university, long seemed resistant to change, it didn't lend itself to scholarship. As politics transformed, starting with Holton's election, Sabato was among a few academics accessible and media savvy who could deftly put a campaign in context. Political analysis, much as politics has been, was a white guy's game. But as Virginia was remade as a suburban-dominated state with a population both national and international, and an economy driven by brains rather than brawn, so too were its politics and ranks of political scholars. More than a dozen experts, men, women, come-heres, and people of color, routinely offer their spin in print, on air, and online, including X, formerly Twitter, where Sabato is particularly active. Over the last generation, Virginia has become an unusually interesting place politically, said Steve Farnsworth, an analyst at the University of Mary Washington since 1966. The change in the political environment here has created lots of opportunity for scholarly work. Scholars are drawn to what is changing, and for a long time, Virginia was not changing. The author of more than a half dozen books and the editor of numerous others, Sabato, a pack rat who lives in a Jefferson-era pavilion on the storied UVA's lawn that's jammed with political paraphernalia, knows that his high profile is accompanied by high risk. For example, Sabato predicted in 1975 that a little-known Georgia governor named Jimmy Carter would win the presidency the following year. In 1985, Sabato repeatedly said Doug Wilder, then running for lieutenant governor, had no chance of becoming the first black person elected statewide in Virginia, still wedded to its racist ways. Wilder won and would become the nation's first elective black governor 4 years later. Said Sabato, referring to the recount that would not affirm Wilder's slender victory until the run-up to Christmas 1989, I predicted that he would win the governorship, and I was almost wrong two times. In Sabato's line of work, it is live by the quote and die by the quote. This was today's Jeff E. Shapiro's opinion piece, The Oracle of Charlottesville Sees Him and Calls Him.
Our next opinion piece comes to you from Kathleen Parker of the Washington Post. This is being read from page A7. Folksy VP pick? Tim Walz isn't exactly what he seems. Deviations from the Truth by Kathleen Parker. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz has surely benefited from his portrayal as the country's football dad, but he wouldn't have passed the truth test in my father's household, where lying was ranked as the highest punishable offense. I'm not saying that Walz lies precisely, but he tends to gild his resume for political gain. Take his 1995 arrest for drunken and reckless driving. Walz, then a 31-year-old high school teacher, was clocked at 96 miles per hour in a 55-mile-per-hour zone in Nebraska. He was pulled over by a state trooper who, upon smelling alcohol, asked Walz to take a field sobriety test, which he failed. Walz then submitted to a blood test, which revealed his alcohol level to be 0.128, well above the state's legal limit. All this information is recorded in public records. Yet during Walz's 2006 congressional campaign, the press was told he hadn't been drinking, that he drove himself to the police station, and that the reason he failed his field sobriety test was because of a misunderstanding related to hearing loss from his time in the National Guard Artillery Unit. In 2018, when Walz was running for governor of Minnesota, he came clean and admitted to drinking and driving. Telling the truth eventually is better than never at all, I suppose, and Walz now refers to his incarceration that night as life-changing. Today, his go-to beverage is Diet Mountain Dew, but Walz's prevarications didn't stop there. Now, admittedly, there's lying and then there's lying. When Walz said he and his wife wouldn't have their two children if not for in vitro fertilization, he was pointing to his Republican opponent, Senator J.D. Vance, whom Walz accused of wanting to eliminate IVF as a fertility option. But the Walzes did not use IVF, according to his wife, Gwen Walz, who clarified the record in a statement. The couple went another less expensive, less invasive route, intrauterine insemination, which is also less ethically challenging because, unlike IVF, no embryos are created outside the womb. This might seem like a small deviation from the truth if Walz hadn't been using the anecdote to attack Vance on a false premise. Both Vance and former President Donald Trump are on record as supporting IVF. Meanwhile, it is doubtful that Walz concerns himself much with the ethics of women's reproductive health, including abortion, since he signed a bill last year that would no longer require doctors to preserve the life of infants who survive abortion. Whereas Minnesota law used to require medical personnel to preserve the life and health of the born alive infant, the Walls approved law says only that doctors care for the infant who is born alive. So care can mean let die if one's conscience permits. Walls's administration cloaks reality with words that neither offend nor inform. Then he employs soothing love language to justify turning Minnesota into a sanctuary state for children seeking transgender treatments. Everybody is welcome in Minnesota, he says, but he also believes that children, in some cases, should be allowed access to surgical and chemical procedures without the consent of their parents. And you thought Republicans were dangerous. Vice President Kamala Harris, the Democratic presidential nominee, seems to prefer that she and Walls, her running mate, grant only joint interviews, which, as Politico said, tend to be softer and focused more on the relationships between the two candidates. Morning show softballs may give comfort to the ill-prepared, but they deny viewers the content they need to be better informed voters. Nothing about the pair's first taped interview with CNN's Dana Bash satisfied that imperative. Though Harris was relatively well-spoken, Walls seemed to be a mixed-up mess. He answered none of the four questions he was asked, including whether he had misspoken when he said he had carried a gun in war when he was never deployed. Walls's Midwestern charm might work for state politics and political rallies, but voters don't need their tires changed or a new gutter. They need to feel confident that Walls can capably step into the presidency if need be. Ask Harris's repackaging team, as Harris's repackaging team tweaked her record to make her seem like a moderate, she studiously selected as her running mate the country's most liberal governor, a man who just happens to fudge reality, exaggerate his accomplishments, and invent half-truths to burnish his resume. And to think, the Democratic Party's big pitch in Chicago was character. That was the opinion piece. Folksy VP pick? Tim Walls isn't exactly what he seems. Written by Kathleen Parker of the Washington Post and read to you from page A7.
On page 7, we have a single letter to the editor, written by Charles Watkins, Colonel, U.S. Air Force, retired from Fredericksburg. Governor Walls is guilty of misrepresenting service. Greg Hawley's opinion piece, Stop Playing Politics with Service Records, on August 27, which makes an impassioned plea that accusations of quote-unquote stolen valor undermine the dignity of all veterans, was very misleading. The Stolen Valor Act pertains to a false claim of military decorations or medals for personal gain, but in public discourse it more broadly describes exaggerations or misrepresentations of military service, which Governor Tim Walz is clearly guilty of. Although he was promoted to Command Sergeant Major, he did not complete the necessary tenure and retired as a Master Sergeant, yet claimed he retired at the highest enlisted rank. He talked about carrying weapons in war, yet he did not see combat or serve in a war zone. His decision to retire just before his unit deployed was completely legal, but his comrades complain this put them in a leadership bind. None of this is political rhetoric, as Mr. Hawley complains, but it is absolutely an affront to the dignity of those who served in his place. Again, this letter is Governor Walls is guilty of misrepresenting service, and it was written by Charles Watkins from Fredericksburg.
We return now to page A2. Ex-Virginia police officer who joined Capitol riot receives a reduced prison sentence, by Michael Kunzelman of the Associated Press. Washington, a former Virginia police officer who stormed the U.S. Capitol, received a reduced prison sentence of 6 years on Wednesday, making him one of the first beneficiaries of a recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling that limited the government's use of a federal obstruction law. More than 2 years ago, former Rocky Mount Police Sergeant Thomas Robertson was originally sentenced to 7 years and 3 months of imprisonment for joining a mob's January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. Prosecutors urged U.S. District Judge Christopher Cooper to preserve the original sentence, but the judge imposed the shorter prison term Wednesday after agreeing to dismiss Robertson's conviction for obstructing the congressional certification of President Joe Biden's 2020 electoral victory. Robertson was the first Capitol riot defendant to be resentenced after the dismissal of a conviction for the obstruction charged at the center of the Supreme Court's ruling in June, according to Justice Department prosecutors. The High Court ruled 6-3 that a charge of obstructing an official proceeding must include proof that a defendant tried to tamper with or destroy documents, a distinction that applies to few January 6th criminal cases. "I assume I won't be seeing you a third time," the judge told Robertson at the end of his second sentencing hearing. Robertson, who declined to address the court at his first sentencing hearing, told the judge on Wednesday that he looks forward to returning home and rebuilding his life after prison. "I realized the positions that I was taking on that day were wrong," he said of January 6th. "I'm standing before you very sorry for what occurred on that day." A jury convicted Robertson on all six counts of his indictment, including charges that he interfered with police officers during a civil disorder and that he entered a restricted area with a dangerous weapon, a large wooden stick. Robertson's jury trial was the second among hundreds of Capitol riot cases. Robertson traveled to Washington on that morning with another off-duty Rocky Mount police officer, Jacob Fracker, and a third man, a neighbor, who wasn't charged in the case. Fracker, who pleaded guilty to a conspiracy charge and agreed to cooperate with the government, was sentenced in 2022 to probation and 2 months of home detention. Jurors who convicted Robertson saw some of his posts on social media before and after the riot. In a Facebook post on November 7, 2020, Robertson said, "Being disenfranchised by fraud is my hard line. I've spent most of my adult life fighting a counterinsurgency. I'm about to become part of one, and a very effective one," he wrote. After January 6th, Robertson told a friend that he was prepared to fight and die in a civil war, and he clung to baseless conspiracy theories that the 2020 election was stolen from then-President Donald Trump. "He's calling for an open armed rebellion. He's prepared to start one," Assistant U.S. Attorney Elizabeth Alloy told the judge. Prosecutors said Robertson used his law enforcement and military training to block police officers who were trying to hold off the advancing mob. Defense Attorney Mark Rollins said Robertson made bad choices and engaged in bad behavior on January 6th, but wasn't trying to overthrow democracy that day. "What you find now is a broken man," Rollins said. The town fired Robertson and Fracker after the riot. That was the article, "Ex-Virginia Police Officer Who Joined Capitol Riot Receives a Reduced Prison Sentence," written by Michael Kunzelman of the Associated Press and taken from page A2.
We are now going to take another short break, but we'll be back in a moment with today's obituaries and more news.